And welcome back. Hour number two. I'm Jeff Rentz. Dr. Ernest L. Martin, among many other things, has supervised over 450 college students at the most significant archaeological excavation ever conducted in Jerusalem for 2 months each year for a period of 5 years, and his archaeological educational program was featured in the education section of Time magazine as well. He has written 8 major research books that are advertised internationally in archaeological and theological periodicals, and over 600 planetariums around the world as well. He is a remarkable man. We are very honored to have him with us tonight. His book, The Temples of Jerusalem Forgot, is, I would consider to be, one of the most important books in a long time, dealing with the Middle East and what is causing the continuing strife and grief there. Dr. Martin, has anyone ever put together a computer simulation in terms of video of what ancient Jerusalem might have looked like based on your research?
We are at the very moment, Jeff, doing that, and the preliminary runs that I have seen are spectacular. I hope to have it ready in a introductory manner in just about 2 weeks' time.
Oh, wonderful.
In fact,
I am attending
a meeting of theologians in Nashville at the SBL meeting. It's the Society for Biblical Literature, where about 8,000 university and college and seminary professors meet, and I'm a member of that organization, and I'm getting ready to show all of this to the people there, the various professionals, and I will have a simulation of how it looked in 3D digital at that time.
You're going to knock them out with that.
I hope so. We really, all of us really need to start looking at this matter because it's a very serious one, simply because of the contemporaneous events that are taking place. And I actually feel that once this information, this historical, geographical, and archaeological information reaches all of us in the world, particularly the professionals, that it will cause many people to think twice before fighting over holy ground that's not so holy.
Well, some people would say, Dr. Martin, right away, that, yeah, so what if it's not where we're at? It's the principle of the thing.
Well, that's what they say, but in this particular case, I'm afraid that you talk to many people in Israel, for example. I mean, even Prime Minister Barak and others have made the statement that the Wailing Wall, which they consider to be a part of the Western Wall of Herod's Temple, and I am saying it's actually a Fort Antonia, and I'm sure we can prove this without any doubt, but they are saying that that's the heart and soul of the Jewish religion.
And
it really should not be, you know, and it isn't, really, when you get down to it, but when people's emotions begin to run pretty wild, I'm talking on all, not just Jewish, but Muslim and Christian, all of us. We find that these geographical areas become very, very important to us.
What would happen if these people were able to read your book, look at the video coming in a couple of weeks, sit down with you and be convinced that they are wrong? What would happen?
I think that it would take some time for it to sink in, to be quite honest, because we have been going in this fashion for about 100 years.
Mm-hmm.
Believe it or not, Jeff, Mount Zion being on the southeast hill, which you will find in all Bible atlases now, every Bible atlas has it down there, Zion, and along with it should be the temple. But do you realize that that was not even solved until 1875, just a little over 100 years ago? If you go back 200 years, people were arguing in England and France and even in Jerusalem and various other places. That's where Mount Zion was, and they placed most of it on the southwest hill of Jerusalem, which is a half a mile away from where it actually is. Now, it should have been solved, this matter of the temple, back there 125 years ago. But most of us, including myself, got our minds just centered on the Haram al-Sharif, that is the square rectangle building that's up there, which is Fort Antonia, and we've equated it with the Temple Mount, and it's become like it's chiseled in stone. Jeff, it's just that solidly engrossed in people's minds. I remember I was on a trip from London to Tel Aviv, and I was talking to a very distinguished gentleman who was dressed like a Jewish rabbi, and we were having a very fine talk, and I mentioned to him that he asked me why I was going to Jerusalem, and I mentioned a little bit about this theory. He looked at me straight in the eye and said, "Preposterous. Completely preposterous." Mm-hmm. And you know, his response was not something that was unfamiliar to me. Mm-hmm. I would have said the same thing myself 10 years ago.
Yeah, I understand.
But this is the problem. It's going to take some time for this to sink in because it's so revolutionary. It really is. I want people to read my book. I have sent it to some of the top authorities, both in Israel, with the Muslims and Christians. And I'm trying to present it to all of our scholar friends, you know, coming up here in about another 2 weeks' time.
This is going to be a very exciting conference. What are the Muslims so wrapped up in that particular location for? Help our listeners who don't know. What is their claim, their historical religious claim to that very same territory?
Well, this is the very interesting part. No claim was made to the Haram al-Sharif, that square building where the Dome of the Rock is, until the Muslims invaded Palestine in 638 A.D. That's 638 years after Christ.
That's a long time.
A long time. And they weren't really interested in the rock, which a little later built over the Dome of the Rock was built over it, until the end of that century, the 7th century.
Mm-hmm.
But once that happened, then we find the domed building over it, they began to think that that was the stone where maybe Abraham sacrificed Isaac. As a result of that, it became rather important to them. And the Muslims, mm-hmm. step by step, began to have superstitious folklore and association with that rock to the extent within 200 years, that rock now had become the site of what they call Muhammad's night journey.
One of the holiest places in all of Islam, yeah?
In all of Islam. Now,
there's no historical precedent for it.
It's, the Kaaba, which is in Mecca, is the central shrine. Then
right,
Medina.
Right,
but now, the Dome of the Rock, and the rock itself, has become the third holiest shrine in all of Islam.
Okay, but
now,
this is traceable back to the 7th century as in terms of its origination. You can actually do this.
Definitely, without any question. We have
right.
historical records that are clear on that.
Right.
But in the 200 to 300 years that followed that, the folklore that got established with that rock is phenomenal. I mean, they then had Muhammad in this night journey, which is mentioned in the Quran, to the furthest mosque, and there have been arguments whether or not that ever was Jerusalem. But anyway, the tradition finally centered on Jerusalem and on that rock. And there is a cave that is located on the southeast corner that you can walk into. I've been there many times.
Mm-hmm.
And that cave, according to Muslim tradition, now get this, it happened because when Muhammad and his horse, Baruch, were going into heaven, the angel Gabriel was accompanying them and lots of other of the prophets, so the story goes, and the rock, mind you, wanted to go into heaven with them. Now, the rock began to ascend, and it got up about 6 feet in the air and then stopped, and we find that Gabriel's hand stopped the rock from going, and the cave that you see there now is a result of the rock falling back somewhat, but not going all the way back. Now, that is the type of tradition that we have with place after place after place in Jerusalem.
Mm-hmm.
Now, whether a person wants to believe it or not, which, of course, is crazy in my view. I mean, it's insanity, you know, to think anything like that. But let's not blame the Muslims. We Christians have as many stories associated with places down there, which are complete fiction, and the Jewish friends, too, they have them as well. And what I am attempting to do is to bring all of us back to rationality over these matters. And I have no problem itself with the original documents, the New Testament, the Old Testament, even with the Quran. But it's the traditions and the folklore and the superstitions that have developed since those times, supplemented primarily by individuals, holy men, having visions, trances, and revelations that have created a complete nonsensical geography for Jerusalem.
Fascinating. Well, on your homepage, and you can click on the link right below Dr. Martin's name at the top of my homepage, and you'll see an artist's rendering of what the temple looked like, and an enormous edifice, as we have been discussing here on the program. So the Dome of the Rock is not over the temple.
No, it is not. In actual fact, the Dome of the Rock is over a former Christian church, which I have fully documented. It's so clear, it makes me wonder why we haven't seen it before.
Yeah.
There was formerly a church there. It was called the Church of the Holy Wisdom.
Mm-hmm.
It was built in Byzantine period, about 200 years before the Muslim invade, 150 years before the Muslims invaded. And it was to cover that rock on which they felt, the Christians at the time, that Jesus' footprints were found when he stood before Pilate in the praetorium as he was sentenced to death.
At that very rock.
At that very rock. And they said that they could show you where Jesus' footprints were. Now, that was in the praetorium, and you know, Jeff, the praetorium means Fort Antonia. And clearly, even when you take the scriptural reference, which is called the rock or the pavement there, that was the rock that the Dome of the Rock now covers, and it was formerly a Christian church raised up in the Byzantine period, and that the Islamic people at the end of the 7th century turned into a Muslim shrine.
Wow, wow, what a history. All right, this is very illuminating, to say the least. Hope you're enjoying it, and we'll take calls a bit later. We've got some more ground to cover with Dr. Ernest L. Martin, his book, Extraordinary, The Temples of Jerusalem Forgot. Click on his homepage link right below his name at the top of my page, which is rents.com. Go there and take a look. Lots of things to see, and we'll continue right after this. Could be that much of the bloodshed, fighting, strife, turmoil, grief that is ongoing in the Middle East now is being predicated on false premises. No one's being accused of doing it deliberately. It just happened that way. We're talking with Dr. Ernest L. Martin about where the location of the temple actually is, and it is not, apparently, where the Wailing Wall is, according to his research, which goes back a long way, and he has, again, spent many, many years working and studying this very carefully. The issue of the position of the temple is central to the book, and it's fascinating to read some of the descriptions that are in the book here. The quotations are multitudes of them. Let me just read one little part here. We can now continue with a more detailed description of the temple and Jerusalem as provided by Aristeas. Is that pronounced correctly?
Aristeas.
Well, that was my second
guess. Either way.
All right, let me read here. We of modern times possess the actual written records of Aristeas. Professor Gifford of England translated an English version of this early writer, which gives Eusebius' rendition. Let us recall that Aristeas was speaking about the Jerusalem of his day, i.e. the early 3rd century before Jesus. In his description of Jerusalem and the temple, he tells us that the interior of the temple, within it, there was an important geographical feature that will serve as a topographical benchmark for determining where the temple was actually located. He said there was, within the temple, a natural spring gushing up. This would have been an artesian spring. It gave an abundance of water to the entire sanctuary. He could not be clearer. Here is a translation of some of his descriptive material. Quoting now, there is an inexhaustible reservoir of water, as would be expected from an abundant spring gushing up naturally from within the temple itself, there being moreover wonderful and indescribable cisterns underground of 5 furlongs, that's 3,000 feet away, according to the drawings. And it goes on and on, but he's quite clear about there being water under that temple. Now, do you still see today a spring in the area of your concern? Dr. Martin.
And, of course, the only spring that there is in Jerusalem and the only one that Aristaeus could be referring to was the Gihon Spring, which is down on the southeast corner of the city of David, where virtually all Bible maps place Zion.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Zion is in the Bible synonymous with the temple. It's over the Gihon Spring. Now, there's only one Gihon, only one spring in the Jerusalem area, and for another 5 miles around, you won't find any other. Not only did Aristaeus say that in the 3rd century B.C., but in the 1st century A.D., Tacitus, the Roman historian, describing the Jewish-Roman War in 66 to 70 A.D., he also said that inside the temple was, and he used the same term, inexhaustible spring that sprang forth water. And there's only one spring that that could possibly be. It's the Gihon, and it's there for anyone to see at the present time. In fact, you can go there, see the spring ushering out of the side of the mountain. There is a tunnel that was constructed in the time of King Hezekiah in the 8th century B.C., about a quarter of a mile long that's goes underneath the mountain down to the southern end of the old city of David,
like
the southeast corner, and the water goes through that. So there can only be one area, Jeff, where by eyewitness description that temple was, and it was on the Ophel Mound just above the Gihon Spring.
It's all here in the book. It's remarkable. The original temple over the Gihon Spring and on and on. I'm just curious as to what this work, this discovery, this, well, assemblage of existing data is going to do to people if they will actually take the time to read it.
What I feel it should do is to make us sit back, all of us who are in the field of history and theology, the professionals and so forth in these fields, and ask ourselves the question, have we been perpetuating even in our teaching, preposterous myths which arise from superstitious beliefs rather than the actual geographical and historically demonstrable truths which we have in front of us. I am hoping that the present belligerents there in the Palestinian area at the present time could read this book. I mean, all sides, Muslims, Christians, Jews, and others, and once they realize that they're fighting over the wrong places in the first place, I would hope a little bit of rationality might come into their minds when they sit around a conference table.
Wow. I just can't imagine the Jews giving up the Wailing Wall.
It's hard. It's going to be very difficult. I talked to one lady in Jerusalem one time in the store about it. She was very intelligent. And she said, well, as far as she was concerned, her religion, her Judaism, was more of a spiritual nature, and it wouldn't upset her so much. But she said, many of the people that I do know, it would be a deadly blow.
It would be devastating. Stand by, Dr. Martin. We'll have to pause, and we'll come right back. If you want to call in and ask any questions, contribute, and welcome to 1-800-876-4123. Be right back. reading in Dr. Martin's book, The Temples of Jerusalem, forgot all about the location of the temple. And I'm reading that Tacitus description. It's just fascinating to read what was written so long ago. You must revel in your work, Dr. Martin.
Entertaining. I should say that.
Yeah.
At the same time, when I read history, it's almost like reading about the present time. It seems like as long as humans have been here on the earth, we experience the same difficulties,
the
same
change,
joys that others have. And,
yeah.
But it is really quite a remarkable thing. And that's been one of my points that I have tried to make in my professional career, that what we really should do is to get back to the documents, what they actually say, rather than making interpretations on the documents or believing what later people, 200 to 300 to 400 years after the documents were written,
right.
what they say. And
well, see,
where our confusion comes in.
Yeah, that's right. Well, that's ego, and that's human beings doing what human beings do.
Exactly.
They basically reinvent the past or reinterpret it.
We're all guilty of it. That's the point. It's a human affliction.
Yeah. All right, here's a Tacitus description, and again, Dr. Martin's book is loaded with marvelous reading material. It's history come alive. The temple resembled a citadel. And remember, we're talking about something 600 feet on the side, 450 feet tall. That's 45 stories. The temple resembled a citadel and had its own walls, which were more laboriously constructed than the others. Even the colonnades with which it was surrounded formed an admirable outwork. It contained an inexhaustible spring. There were subterranean excavations into the hill, and tanks and cisterns for holding rainwater. The founders of the state had foreseen that frequent wars would result from the singularity of its customs, and so had made every provision against the most protracted siege. Was the temple then basically a fortress?
Yes, it was. You hit the nail on the head. Josephus, the eyewitness who lived through the whole war. He was born in 37 A.D. and died at about 105 A.D. He wrote the Antiquities of the Jews, a long work about, which is parallel to the Bible, and then also he wrote seven books, well, one long work on the Jewish war itself. And he mentions about the temple itself being a fortress. He said there were actually three fortresses in Jerusalem. There was the fortress of Herod's palace up in the upper city just to the west. Then there was the temple, which itself was a fortress, and intended to be that. And just to the north of the temple, and overlooking the temple, and larger than the temple, was Fort Antonia.
Larger.
He actually says that Fort Antonia was so large that it could contain several cities. He used, now, okay, we can say that's an exaggeration, but that's what he says. And that it was capable of holding a whole division, legion, actually, he were for the Roman Imperial Army, which would be a division of troops, 5,000, but with support of people, about 10,000 troops, could live in this building called Fort Antonia. And it overshadowed the temple. In fact, from the north, anyone coming into Jerusalem could not even see the temple because of this huge, massive fort standing in the way. And by the way, you are seeing, when you go to Jerusalem today, the remnants of that very building called the Fort Antonia, and that is today mistaken for the Temple Mount, but it is not. The Temple Mount and where the Dome of the Rock is, there are no springs there at all. The only spring in Jerusalem, and I'm glad you're quoting Tacitus again, Jeff, he just gives this eyewitness account that the spring was inside the temple precincts, and there you have it.
What about the Crusades? Did anybody come back with a viable history of Jerusalem? Did they do any scholarship when they were there? Did they take the Arabs, the historians that the Arabic civilization spawned and tried to
We have
together.
Pretty good accounts of what happened both on the European and on the Muslim side. And the Gihon Spring, by the way, is mentioned there.
It is.
However, at the time that the Crusades, which started in 1099 A.D., that spring had just turned bitter. And that's a very important point that I have in my book, that as long as the temples were there and the spring, the Gihon spring, was operating normally and naturally, mm-hmm. Josephus, the Jewish historian again, he described the waters as being some of the nicest water that you could possibly imagine. Huh. They're just really fresh and beautiful and wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
But the in about 1077 A.D., somewhere between 1033 and 1077, we cannot pinpoint it exactly, there was a major earthquake in the area, and after that earthquake, those waters turned bitter. And they have been bitter to this very day. And if you go down there, it's advisable that you do not drink any of the water that comes from the Gihon Spring. And I would suspect that if you went to the old city and walked through it, and then went down to the Gihon Spring and see the nice bubbling water coming out down there, you would know where it's coming from. It's not too palatable today. But in the old days, it was the waters of salvation, as David described them as being fresh water coming from out underneath the Ophel mound and within the temple precincts. And in the time of Jeremiah, he does say that there was a bitterness to the water at that time that lasted for a short period. So find that from time to time, the waters do change their characteristics. But in the time the temples were there, it was fresh water. Now it's not.
I see. How much of a flow are we talking about here? Just give me an idea.
It depends. It's a gurgling spring. It's called a karst spring. Now, a karst spring is one which does not flow all the time. It will flow for about 45 minutes, and then it will not flow for an hour or two, three or four. In the springtime, when the snows in the mountains around, and it does snow, by the way, in Jerusalem most years, when it's melting and you get heavy rainstorms, the water will come forth from the Gihon Spring quite copiously.
Right.
But it still has a karst effect. It will not come continuously.
Interesting. All right, stand by. We'll pause and come right back with Dr. Ernest L. Martin, whose book, The Temples at Jerusalem Forgot. Okay, we're back, and looking at some of the plates again in the book, and there is a marvelous drawing of a classic Roman fort, which I guess Fort Antonia would have looked like very much. It's extraordinarily detailed. Where did this diagram come from?
It comes from a book that's written about the Roman Imperial Army. It's just come out recently.
And it's
quite a number of pictures of ancient Roman forts.
Oh, yeah.
This is the one that's in Jerusalem, which is, I'm saying, the Haram Sharif. It's very close to the one in Rome itself in dimensions. In fact, it's slightly larger.
Huh. The detail work in this fort is extraordinary.
Yes, indeed.
Each
Roman fort was a city in itself. It was something similar to our own armed forces in Europe. When we go to a base in Europe, we see a little America there with everything from McDonald's, etc. The Romans did virtually the same thing wherever they went, and particularly in Jerusalem. Now, that fort was built by King Herod, but in 6 A.D., just while Christ was an infant, it was taken over by the Romans, and the Romans continued it until the destruction of Jerusalem. And in fact, after the destruction was over, that is the place that Titus, who was the Roman general, selected for the 10th Legion to remain in the area to supervise the region. And what better place than the former Roman fort?
Mm-hmm.
And as a matter of fact, Jeff, I think it'd be good for your listeners to know that Josephus, he records about what happened just after the war. 3 years later, down at Masada, is where the 960 Jewish remnants of the war, they killed themselves before surrendering to General Silva of the Roman army.
Mm-hmm.
And we know the story of Masada is quite a beautiful and interesting story. But that happened 3 years after the war was over, and Eliezer, who was in charge of the Jewish people there at that time, said that the only thing left in Jerusalem, he said the temple was in ruins, the city was nothing, The only thing left was the Roman encampment, which had been there before. And, of course, the only thing that has come down to us today from the Herodian period, with rocks or stones still in place, is the Haramah Sharif, and that's what he was talking about.
And how much of it is left? Just the one wall?
No, there are four walls.
But
the northern wall is practically gone, but
the eastern
wall is practically intact, the southern, and also the western. There's one stone in the western wall that you can get down to. You have to climb down to it. That weighs 400 tons.
Well, that's
stone.
That's Egyptian proportions.
Exactly. And some of the stones around the southwest corner are 60 feet long and about 4 to 5 feet high, and they are in the neighborhood of 70 tons.
Wow.
Each stone.
Right.
And there are over 10,000 of them.
Yeah, I still want to know how they took that temple apart.
Well, they...
I guess they go down quicker than they go up. That's all.
The temple was not only a fortress. It was, like Fort Knox, it was the treasury of the Jewish nation. Josephus, remarkably, we were talking about human nature and civilization. They actually had what we call safety deposit boxes in the temple that people from all over the Roman and the Parthian worlds, they would actually... leave in care of the priests there. So in some cases it was the treasury of the nation.
Tell me a little bit more about the war with the Jews. That occurred over how many years ago?
It took place from 66 AD, from the autumn time, just before the Sukkot, as it's called, or the Feast of Tabernacles, in the autumn of 66 to 70 AD. It was destroyed. The temple went up in flames on the 10th day of the night of the 5th month, the month of Ab. And remarkably, that's in our August, about in our August time. And remarkably, Jeff, that temple went up in flames by accident, as a matter of fact. And Titus, the Roman general, we're told, tried to put out the flames. I mean, to have his troops to do it, but it was impossible to do. But it was completely destroyed and burnt down, not that the stones were, but I mean they fell down and all the support system was destroyed on that 9th and 10th of Ab, on the exact anniversary that the temple was destroyed in the time of Nebuchadnezzar some 600 years before.
Oh, wow.
Exactly,
that must have been,
on the same day.
It's extraordinary. Well, they say there are no accidents. Who knows?
It makes you wonder, doesn't it?
It does. That must have been one heck of a conflagration.
It was. There are some beautiful paintings of it that the artists have rendered, and honestly, it would have been a conflagration. That could have been seen from the moon easily.
it sounds like it. The wars themselves were fought in and around Jerusalem. Over what period of countryside was this conflict carried out? How wide-ranging were these battles?
Well, they were mostly confined, the one that destroyed Jerusalem and the temple was confined to the city itself at that time. Later on, in the second century, in 132 to 135, in the time of Hadrian, there were wars all over the area. That was the final Jewish war with the Romans. But the one that we are talking about here occupied the space of Jerusalem itself. There were five legions there, four in actual fact with auxiliaries, and each of them had about 5,000 men.
20,000, yeah. It's amazing that people are still dying today. It's almost a killing ground if you look at it over the millennia.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Now, I have written about some prophecies in the book of Zechariah that actually speak of time of reconciliation coming, and it appears to be before what we Christians would call the second advent of Christ. A spirit of grace and supplication, Zechariah says, is going to come to that area. But from any perspective that we could look at today, that description there seems so remote that it would be impossible of happening.
That's
but on the other hand, it is in the prophecies that a reconciliation among the peoples there is to transpire, and of course I would wish that would happen soon.
I completely agree. This book is, again, just published. It is The Temples of Jerusalem Forgot. I would urge you to get a copy of it. Pass it on to anyone else who's interested as well. All you can do is start, I guess, at the bottom, Dr. Martin, and spread the word. You're going to take it to the conference, and you say 6,000 or 8,000 people are going to attend?
About 8,000 of us will attend there from the various universities around the world. And these are the top scholars, and I will be displaying it at that time. And Professor James Tabor from the University of North Carolina will be discussing this whole issue, and he is very much in favor of everyone looking at it thoroughly, because it is a subject that needs to serious investigation. He has given me one of the finest quotes that I can get on the reliability of at least my material and of its urgency. And I do believe that soon that people throughout the world will begin to understand this matter much, much more than they do right now. And when we do find out that people are fighting over the wrong places, again, I say, Jeff, I hope that it will cause us to look in other directions before we start fighting again.
Oh, I completely agree. You have written other books, a number of other books, and as we approach the holiday season, the book, The Star That Astonished the World, The Star of Bethlehem, the real story of Jesus, I think it's something we might want to spend a little time on during the next hour.
Well, I would love to talk about that. As a matter of fact, that book... I wrote that back in 1980, and the newest revision is 1994. And Griffith Observatory, on their webpage, they give quite a good splash on it, even to this very day. And they've been showing it for since 1980, and over 600 planetariums around the world are showing my new discoveries on what was happening at the time of the Nativity.
That's amazing. They all base their shows on your research.
Well, on this book, The Star That Astonished the World, yes, and it's quite an interesting historical and astronomical story. And Matthew, when he talked about the star that was associated with the Magi, he was only giving the tip of the iceberg of what was happening in the celestials at that time. It was quite a pageant going on that really inspired the Magi to come to Jerusalem and to Herod to give their gifts to the Christ child.
Extraordinary.
It's remarkable. If you see a planetarium show on it, the oohs and the ahs are all over the place.
And it must make you proud to know your work is reaching so many people.
Well, it's getting to, and the main thing about it is it shows, in my view, and I just mentioned to your audience from where I'm coming, I want people to get their... themselves back into the original documents of the Old Testament and the New Testament and historical records, and let's see what they say. I'm not someone trying to give my interpretation. I mean, every one of us should be a man and woman enough to do what we want to there. But if we can just re-examine what the original documents say, we may be in for some surprises.
You've proven that with your book, The Temples of Jerusalem for God, no doubt. Okay, we're going to pause and come back and spend some more time with Dr. Martin next hour talking about the star that astonished the world as we approach yet another holiday season, a holiday season of strife, but maybe things, as Dr. Martin suggested, are headed towards some kind of a reconciliation, let's hope so. All right, we'll be back after the top of the hour news break. Don't forget to visit my website at rents.com. It's R-E-N-S-E. New stories of an important nature going up around the clock for you from all around the world, and I hope you'll stop in and take a look. Almost 12,000 stories now housed in the archives right there for you. And our program's archived all the way back to 1997. You can hear any show you'd like going back to 1997. Anytime, anywhere in the world, just get online and enjoy. All right, we'll be back in just a few minutes. I'm going to go to the hospital. Okay, hour number three. I'm Jeff Runch here with you 6 nights a week, 3 hours a night as we roll into election week. It's the year 2000, the election day after tomorrow. And got some interesting things planned for you as we roll through the next 3 days in which this country will make a decision. Some people say the decision is like choosing between arsenic and strychnine. I don't know. I don't know who you're going to vote for, Dr. Martin, but if you're going to vote at all. But it's my goodness, is this the best we have? That's what people keep saying.
I didn't realize how poetic you were.
Well, it's a momentary lapse. The temples, the book is The Temples of Jerusalem Forgot by Dr. Ernest L. Martin. Clearly one of the most, I think, potentially important books done on the Middle East and our ancient and contemporary history in my lifetime. This is extraordinary when you consider that for the last 100+ years, people have been living on the wrong assumptions, and history proves them wrong, does it not?
It certainly does. And the matter of the Wailing Wall, for example, the Western Wall, I was rather shocked to find out myself about 10 years ago that Jewish participation in that particular section, which we now call the Wailing Wall, was only in effect from around 1520 A.D. onward. And the two stories, both promoted by Jewish historians of the 17th century, clearly show that it was, first of all, a Christian shrine, a place, and then the Muslims took it over and cleaned it up. But Jewish participation in the area of the Wailing Wall did not take place until the time of Rabbi Isaac Luria, called the Ari, or the Lion. Most Jewish people would certainly know of him, in the year 1570. And before that time, no Jewish person had ever gone to the Wailing Wall for any spiritual reason whatsoever. I mean, the one that we are seeing there in the news every day.
Is that because they knew it wasn't part of the temple?
By that time, most of the Jews considered the temple to be at the Dome of the Rock. From the time of the Crusades onward, Jeff, most people, Jews, Christians, and Muslims, accepted the Dome of the Rock. I have in my book, though, a considerable abundance evidence to show that prior to the Crusades, particularly prior to 1077 A.D., all Jews knew clearly that the temple was over the Gihon Spring that we had been talking about. And I have absolute evidence in the scriptures, in my book, in which I have material from what they call the Giza Synagogue writings, contemporary writings, which show that the temple was south of the Hamam HaSharif, and down on the Ophel Mound, and it's actually in these records, which I have accumulated in my book.
Yeah,
the Wailing Wall that we have today is a modern invention. Well, modern, 400 years, 380 years.
It's modern enough.
And believe it or not, this is documented very well in a Ministry of Defense, Israel, Ministry of Defense publication on the Western Wall. And it's all documented there by our Jewish scholars themselves that this is the case.
That's amazing. Again, this is going to make a tremendous impact at the conference in 2 weeks. We'll see.
I hope so.
Yeah, I want you to let me know via email when you get back, please, how the reception was and what happened. And I just hope this information gets out and is given proper and due consideration by all of those at the top levels of both sides in this continuing conflict, because it needs to be factored in.
Well, you're absolutely right, and I want to thank you personally for this opportunity of introducing it to your listeners, because in actual fact, your program is the first on record of giving this information out in this fashion. So I want to thank you. It's just before the conference is taking place down there. And as I said, Professor James Tabor from the University of North Carolina is going to be giving a lecture on this very subject, and it should prove to be a very exciting one. At least I would think so, because of the great importance that we see in this matter.
The emotional impact of your work will run the gamut.
Well, I hope so.
Yeah.
I feel that what I have given is basically the truth. I would be silly to say that everything I have in the book is 100% accurate. As far as I know, it is. But the thing is, if there is a little brick here and there scarred on my evidence, the walls are going to stand. I have not the slightest doubt that what I have stated in that book is true.
Well, it's an extraordinary book to look at and to consider, and let's find out what happens. All you can do is put it out there, as they say.
You betcha.
All right. We come across another holiday season, and they seem to show up about every 6 months now. Are you noticing how time is speeding up?
Well, my goodness, yes.
I mean, it is really silly. Not only is time increasing in its rapidity, but people everywhere, Dr. Martin, seem to be on edge. They're just not. There's an undercurrent of anxiety that is international.
You're right. There's the ubiquitous anxiety that is seemingly around now in this time of great prosperity for the United States, and yet there's seemingly an uncertainty that's hovering on the horizon.
Does the Bible talk about these particular times to your satisfaction in terms of really prophetically preparing us for what we're going through now?
I personally feel so. I am. I feel that everything is on schedule as far as the prophetic scenario is concerned. What I read in the book of Zechariah, particularly the last six chapters, seem to pinpoint the effects in Jerusalem and in Israel at the present time. It also gives a very nice outcome to what will happen down there and prior to the second advent of Christ. Good times are going to be coming down there, but if the prophecies in Zechariah mean anything at all in the 12th chapter.
Yeah, and yet you did make a point earlier that this seems to be almost a cyclical build-up to not much, and then it cycles around again and again and again.
That's right, and even in the book of Isaiah, it speaks in about the 43rd chapter about former things will take place in the future, as though everything in life is cyclical.
Repetitive, yeah.
Repetitive. And you find that also in the book of Ecclesiastes by Solomon. Mm-hmm. Several places he states that.
Well, I think, you know, one of the interesting things about your book, The Temples of Jerusalem for God, and I hope it has given adequate coverage at the conference, is that you have again elevated Christ's teachings to you brought him up a half a level or two.
I hope so.
Because his prophecy is borne out by your research now.
I gave the book to a Catholic priest up in San Francisco, and we were having some convivial time, social engagement, and he read the book and came back to me 2 days later, rather ashen-faced, to say, like you have, and I'm very thankful for your recommendation. He said this is going to actually change history, but he said, from what you have said, I cannot see any other answer but that is the truth.
Yeah.
So this goes beyond the denominational lines. It's not a matter of being Protestant or Catholic or Orthodox or Muslim or Jewish.
You're simply rediscovering.
These are clear historical facts that I'm trying to give forth to the world.
You're rediscovering our real, literal history.
That's correct. Mm-hmm. And like I've said, I have a deep respect for the documents. And I mean the biblical documents, but also the historical documents.
Mm-hmm.
And whereas I have found that when people say the historical documents are exaggerating what they say, I find in most cases the exaggeration is because of our misinterpretation of history.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I've heard that before as well. All right, now your other book that we'll talk about here in this hour in our time remaining, and there are a number of books which you'll find all listed at Dr. Martin's website. Just go there by clicking on the information right below his name at the top of my home page. It's real simple. If you're not online right now, it's askelm.com. Maybe you can remember that, www.askelm.com. And it's a marvelous website. All right, The Star That Astonished the World. I remember when this book was revised, I think you said 94?
Yes, brought out my final edition of it. And Jack Finnegan, Professor Finnegan, who wrote the Handbook of Biblical Chronology,
mm-hmm.
I now have his approbation on my information in that book, and he's given me special notice that he has changed his mind to the fact that Jesus was born in the year 3 to 2 BC rather than the normal 4, 5, 6, or 7 that most of us thought of before, and that the astronomical information that we find going on at the time is rather spectacular. There was a celestial pageantry in the heavens dealing with the stellar positions as well as the planetary, lunar, and solar, that really staggers the mind. And when you read my book at what was actually going on at the time, the people living there in that generation when Jesus was born, they were given a spectacular show that even Spielberg couldn't quite come up to.
All right, well, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, I'd like you to try and give us a mind's eye portrait of what the skies may have looked like. And again, the information in Dr. Martin's book, The Star That Astonished the World, is the bedrock for the holiday programming in over 600 planetariums in the United States and Europe. You've probably seen his shows, many of you who have been in planetariums around this time of year. So we'll hear about that and more with Dr. Ernest L. Martin in just a couple minutes.